Chapter 2. St. Patrick and St. Martin. The period of our saint's life to which we have now come embraces those years which he spent in preparation for his apostolate. His probation was long and searching, and in proportion to the greatness of God's purposes with his servant. It is the part of his life of which we have the best authentic record, but if we remember the circumstances of the time, it will help us to understand how great must have been his difficulties and how persevering the energy which surmounted them. St. Patrick had to fit himself for the priesthood and apostolate in those calamitous years which followed the death of Theodosius the Great. During this time, Rome was 3 times besieged, and afterwards sacked and set on fire by Alaric and his Goths. Then came horde after horde of barbarians, involving the cities of the empire and the sanctuaries of the church in a common destruction. A great part of the East was infested by heresy, and paganism still held possession of half of France and the best part of Germany. It was an age when God seemed to make the fate of the world depend upon a few great men, whose light shone all the brighter from the darkness which surrounded them. When St. Ambrose was the oracle of Italy, and St. Augustine upheld the faith in Africa, when St. Jerome kept watch over the written word at Bethlehem, and St. John Chrysostom resisted heresy in high places at Constantinople. But no saint was doing more for the Western Church than St. Martin, the great bishop of Tours, who was in his zenith of his glory, and at that last decade of the 4th century, when his young kinsmen set out on his search for the mountains of ecclesiastical spirit and doctrine. It is natural, therefore, that St. Patrick should direct his first steps to Marmortier, the famous monastery near Tours, which had been founded by St. Martin, who, first monk, then bishop, returned to the desert in his old age, and with his 80 followers imitated and rivaled the austerities of the Eastern solitaries. 2,000 monks followed him to the grave, and so great was the popular veneration in which he was held, that for some time in France, the day after his death was taken as the starting point of a new era, and the years were counted from it. Both St. Evan and Probus mention St. Patrick's journey to Tours, and his stay with St. Martin. The first-named writer tells us that our saint received the monastic tonsure, and from that moment he put away all earthly pleasures and cares, and resolved never more to eat meat. And Probus adds that he received his learning and doctrine from St. Martin, whose double spirit was given to one who may be called his greatest disciple. The Bollandists and Tillemont fix 397 as the date of St. Martin's death. It is probable, therefore, that his kinsman was one of those who wept and prayed by the dying saint in that well-known scene, when he consented to prolong his exile on earth, if it were still necessary to his people. There is an ancient tradition that St. Ambrose, when at Milan, bilocated, being at the same time miraculously present at the funeral of St. Martin of Tours, so our saint may have had the privilege of seeing him who brought Theodosius to repentance, and whose memory lives in the church as the representative of Her Majesty and reproving the sins of earthly rulers. The traditions of the churches of Milan and Tours both record the fact, which is thus related by St. Gregory of Tours, writing in the 6th century, "It came to pass on this day of the Lord, after the lection of the prophet, when the reader, standing before the altar, was about to begin that of St. Paul, the most blessed Bishop Ambrose slept at the altar. Many saw it, but no one presumed to awaken him until 2 or 3 hours had passed in this way. Then they roused him, saying, 'The hour is past. Let our Lord command the reader to proceed, for the wearied people are waiting.' Then the Bishop Ambrose replied, 'Be not troubled, for the sleep has been of great profit to me, to whom God has manifested so great a miracle. For you must know that the soul of my brother Martin, the priest, has departed, and that I have paid the last offices to him in the usual way. The little chapter alone I have not finished, because of your interruption.' In astonishment and wonder they noted the day, and having made careful inquiries, they found that the saint had passed away on the same day, and at the same time when the blessed confessor had declared that he had assisted at his obsequies. Immediately after the narrative of his escape from captivity given in the confession, St. Patrick adds that after a few years he revisited his relations. St. Elrond tells us that he was about 30 years of age, and as we gather from his own words, that he received holy orders at this time. And this was probably his farewell visit on the eve of his ordination. He gives a touching account of the affection shown him by his kinfolk, who tried hard to retain him with them, reminding him of all he had endured since they had been separated. The saint does not tell us whether his resolution faltered under this assault of flesh and blood, but it seems to have been a hard one, and he was supernaturally supported by a vision, which he thus describes. In the bosom of the night I saw a man who seemed to come from Ireland, and he bore innumerable letters with him, one of which he gave to me. And I read the beginning of the letter in which was written, The Voice of the Irish, and as I read aloud the first words of the letter, I thought I heard in my mind the voices of those who were nigh to the forest of Foshulut, which borders the western sea, and they cried out, We entreat thee, holy youth, to come and walk still among us. And my heart was deeply pierced, so that I could read no more, and so I awoke, thanks be to God, that after many years the Lord hath granted their desire, as they cried to him. Of the years intervening between his vision and the mission to Ireland, we have but very scant records. We can only conjecture, from the society which the saint was placed, what sort of life he must have led. Part of his time was passed in the island of Lorenz, the Insula Termaneris, or Insula Beata, as it was then styled, one of the most famous sanctuaries of piety and learning in the world. Half monastery and half university, it filled France with saints and doctors. In the West it ranks amongst the earliest of those great ecclesiastical strongholds for the training of apostles and missionary bishops, which were so necessary in those wild times, and so St. Patrick's life of preparation was thus the figure of those things which were to come when his sons and successors passed through a similar novitiate in the great Irish monasteries at home, or in their colonies at Luxeuil, Yonne, and Lindisfarne. Lorenz, in St. Patrick's time, was sanctified by the presence of St. Hilary of Arles, St. Eucharis of Lyons, St. Lupus of Troyes, and St. Vincent of Lorenz, and it was as a pupil of this great school that St. Patrick first made his appearance in Rome. The same supernatural attraction which had guided St. Patrick to Montmartre and Lorenz led him to place himself under the spiritual direction of St. Germanus, Bishop of Auxerre. He spent many years with him, in patience, obedience, charity, and chastity, and sanctity of heart and soul, preserving his virginity in the fear of the Lord, and living in goodness and simplicity during the whole period of his mortal career. St. Germanus was well suited to complete the training of the future apostle. Perhaps no bishop in Gaul at that time had a greater reputation for sanctity and learning. He seems to have taken St. Martin's place in the French church, and it was in his company that St. Patrick began his apostolic career. The Pelagian heresy then infected Britain, and the reigning pope, St. Celestine, had sent St. Palladius, archdeacon of Rome, into the country to support the Orthodox party. But he had so little success that he was compelled to ask the Pope for help, and at the same time there came a deputation from Britain to the bishops of France imploring them to grant the missionaries capable of opposing the advances of the heresy. St. Germanus was appointed by the Pope as his legate for this purpose, and the bishops of France induced St. Lupus of Troyes to accompany him. St. Patrick was one of their company. And, as every meeting with a saint is a great event in life, it is worthy of mention that as the legate and his attendants passed through the village of Nanterre, near Paris, they found there Saint Genevieve. She was then about 10 years old, but Saint Germanus foresaw and foretold the sublime sanctity of the future patroness of Paris, and leading the child to the church, she made, in his presence, her solemn consecration to God. The great success of St. Germanus in Britain is well known, and St. Patrick had his share in the work. It is recorded that in one city the preaching of the legate producing no fruit, he took counsel with his followers as to the course they should adopt, and that, when our saint's turn to speak came, he said, Let us for 3 days observe a rigorous fast at the city gates, and then leave the matter in the hands of God. His advice was taken, and a manifest interposition of God was obtained by this act of evangelical penance. We have already seen from his confession that St. Patrick well knew the power of fasting in obtaining help from God, but here he appears to have consecrated an Irish pagan custom to a Christian purpose. Footnote. A full account of this very beautiful custom may be found in the Introduction to Ancient Laws and Institutes of Ireland. In cases where any one of rank of a chieftain unjustly withheld payment of a lawful claim, the creditor had the right to fast on him, which consisted in going into his residence and waiting there for a certain time without food. If the chieftain did not relent, the law then took its course. The writer adds that the same observance is to be found amongst the Hindus, where this sort of compulsion is used even against princes and may not be resisted by force. End footnote. Saint Germanus and his companions were sent to Britain in 429, and it was about this time that the Vicar of Christ, upon whom rests the burden of the world's conversion, turned his eyes on Ireland, and determined to gain her for his master. And with this end in view, he sent Saint Palladius, who had been already at work in Britain. But as it has been in that country, so now in Ireland, St. Palladius had to make way for another. The result of his mission is thus described by one who wrote some 2 centuries after the death of St. Patrick. Palladius, archdeacon of Pope Celestine, bishop of Rome, and the 45th successor of St. Peter in the Apostolic See, was ordained and sent to convert this island, lying under wintry cold. But he was unsuccessful, for no one can receive anything from earth unless it be given to him from heaven. And neither did these fierce barbarians receive his doctrine readily, nor did he himself wish to remain long in a land not his own. Wherefore he returned to him who sent him. On the way, however, after passing the first sea, having begun his land journey, he died in the territory of the Britons. When St. Germanus heard that the missionaries from Rome had begun their work in Ireland, he saw that Patrick's time was now come. Our saint was then far advanced in years, and his life, from his childhood, had been one long preparation for this mission to which he had been so plainly called by God. He therefore set out for Rome to obtain the Pope's sanction and benediction. But first, says Probus, he prayed thus to God, O Lord Jesus Christ, lead me, I beseech thee, to the seat of the Holy Roman Church, that receiving authority there to preach with confidence thy sacred truths, the Irish nation may, through my ministry, be gathered to the fold of Christ. Soon after, the man of God, Patrick, being about to proceed to Ireland, went, as he had desired, to Rome, the head of all the churches, and having asked and received the apostolic benediction, he returned, pursuing the same road by which he had journeyed thither. We have now come to the question of St. Patrick's mission from Rome. When we compare the narrative in Probus with that of St. Evan, it is evident that St. Patrick received 2 missions from Pope St. Celestine, and that the first, the one here alluded to, took place before the news of the death of St. Palladius had reached Rome, when St. Patrick was a simple priest, and the second, when having set out on his road to Ireland to assist in the apostolic work already going on, and having heard of the death of St. Palladius and the failure of his enterprise, he retraced his steps and received from St. Celestine the office which had already been given to St. Palladius. The contradictory statements made by old writers as to the place of St. Patrick's consecration and the name of his consecrator are probably to be attributed to their confounding these 2 missions. As to the view that St. Patrick could not be dependent on the Pope if he received his mission from St. Germanus, who was legate of the Holy See in Britain in 429, and again in 446, it is so hard even to see what it means that we shall not attempt to meet it, contenting ourselves with the following account of St. Patrick's consecration borrowed from an author, who on this question has left little to be added by subsequent writers, simply premising that it is cumulative evidence which should be regarded in a question like this. When St. Evan wrote that St. Patrick was consecrated at Rome, he had probably very little idea of the geography of Italy. In the following extract, Monsignor Moran agrees with the Bollandists in fixing the spot of St. Patrick's consecration at the modern Evria, styled Ebora by Father Colgan, and Moria in the Book of Armagh at Ebaboria by Probus. John of Tynemouth writes that St. Patrick turned aside on his journey to a certain famous man named Amator, a chief bishop and saint, and obtained the rank of bishop from him. Probus says he was a man of wondrous sanctity, and a chief bishop, and Macuthinus in the Book of Armagh also styles him a wonderful man, a chief bishop. Now it is difficult, says Monsignor Moran, to conceive a bishop so remarkable amongst his contemporaries, and so famed for his sanctity, and yet uncommemorated in the many records of the French Church about the year 430. Neither in the synod then held in France, nor in the lives of St. Germanus and the other great ornaments of France at that time, is there found any mention of his name. But if in Gaul neither a town can be found to correspond with Eboria, as all acknowledge, nor a bishop who might answer for St. Amator, can such a town and such a bishop be found in Italy? We unhesitatingly answer that they can. Indeed, as to the town in which St. Patrick received the intelligence of the death of Palladius, we precisely find at the foot of the Alps in Eboria, or Eprio, or Eporia, also styled Eponia in Eropidia, lying in the route from Ravenna, which probably St. Germanus then lived, to Gaul in Ireland. This is the modern town of Evreux. Formerly, travelers passed through it in journeying from Italy to Gaul. It was the route pursued by the army of Hannibal in olden times, as by the first Napoleon in the beginning of this century. Narrator's remark. This book was written in the 1800s. End narrator's remark. What is more striking, it was the road hollowed by the relics of St. Germanus when they were translated with solemn pomp from Ravenna to Auxerre. We learn that from Ravenna they were first conducted to Vercelli, and there the presence of the angelic choir around the saint's relics was said to have dedicated the newly built cathedral. From Vercelli to Ivrea, and thence along the Alps, the triumphal route is marked by the many churches dedicated to St. Germanus, each of which was erected on the spot which his precious relics were deposited for a little while. Thus, in the town and small diocese of Ivrea, there are at present 7 chapels bearing the name of St. Germanus, and marking the route taken in this sacred procession. It is perhaps no small confirmation of the opinion that Eporia, or Evria, was the town thus referred to by our ancient writers, that it brings together all the elements of their at first sight discordant narrative. We understand at once how our apostle is said to have been on his way from Pope Celestine when he received in Eboria the news of the death of St. Palladius. We understand how it is that St. Patrick's consecration is so emphatically described as having been performed in a neighboring town, in conspecto Theodosi, in conspecto Celestini, and again in conspecto Germani. There is nothing, indeed, to prevent these accounts from being literally true. The history of St. Germanus justifies the conjecture that he was then actually at the court of the emperor, who often journeyed to and fro from Ravenna to the imperial city Turin, the Augusta Taurinorium of those times. The popes, too, are often met with, even in the scanty records of that age that have come down to us, visiting Ravenna, the headquarters of the Western Empire, and other cities of North Italy. Thus again, another point becomes intelligible on which our ancient writers are agreed, and which, nevertheless, was wholly unintelligible on the supposition of St. Patrick's consecration having been celebrated in Gaul, that at the time of his consecration, St. Celestine gave him the name Patricus, i.e. Patrick. This was a name commonly assumed in Italy in the 5th century, as Gibbon assures us. Now, the Book of Hymns in the Schola of St. Fiach attests that Patricus was his name at his degree, i.e., the highest order of consecration, and it was Celestine, the Camard of Peter, who gave it to him. Someone will perhaps say that there was no saint at that time in the north of Italy whose name corresponds with Amator or Amothorax, remarkably for his learning and sanctity. We reply that there was at this time the great St. Maximus ruling the See of Turin, which city, in a straight course, is not more distant than a few miles from Evria. The name Maximus in the old Celtic form would be precisely Amahor. And the transition from that to the various Latinized names given above is easily explained. From all this we may conclude that St. Patrick, when he received intelligence of the death of St. Palladius, was still in close relation with Pope Celestine, as also the Emperor and St. Germanus, that the town of Arborea, at which he had arrived with the intelligence was brought to him, is no other than the modern town of Ivrea, hallowed by the memory of the other ornaments of the church. St. Malachy and the blessed Thaddeus, and in fine, and it was the great doctrine of Turin, the illustrious St. Maximus, that our apostle received his episcopal consecration. St. Patrick in his confession tells us of a vision granted to him, which appears to have had some mysterious connection with his own consecration as bishop. His words are, "On another night, whether within me or near me, God knows, I heard profound words, and had no intelligence of them until the end, when it was said, He who gave his life for thee is he who speaks within thee. And so I awoke filled with joy, and again I saw one praying within me, and I was, as it were, within my body, and I heard that it is above the inner man, and that he prayed earnestly with groanings. And I was stupefied, and filled with wonder, and considered who this could be who prayed in me. But at the end of prayer it came to pass that it was a bishop, and I awoke and remembered that the apostle said, Likewise the Spirit also helpeth our infirmities, for we know not what we should pray for as we ought, but the Spirit himself asketh for us with unspeakable groanings, and again, the Lord is our advocate, who also makes intercession for us. St. Patrick has now reached his 60th year. The graces of his youth, the divine lessons of adversity, and the society of the wisest and holiest men of the age had combined to prepare him for his mission. And with the blessing of the Vicar of Christ and of the friend and guide of his youth, St. Germanus, he set out on his way to Ireland. We gather from his own words that he turned neither to the right nor the left. Did I come, he writes, to Ireland according to God or according to the flesh? Who compelled me? I was led by the Spirit that I should see my relations no more. He was consecrated bishop in 432, and in that year Christ sent him to make that covenant with Ireland which has remained unbroken for 14 centuries. In that very year the great Pope St. Celestine died. He had just confirmed the decrees of the Council of Ephesus and vindicated the honor of the Mother of God, and it seemed as if his eternal recompense was only deferred just long enough to give him the glory of founding the church in Ireland.